Good evening. This is the first night of the six-week practice period that we're beginning, that will end on the last day of Sesshin, on the 14th of August. We've done practice periods for many years, in a very informal way. Often, most Zen centers require contracts from the students, contracts with the teacher, and a lot of commitment that gets checked on. And in our practice with Kobin, it was very different from that. He always said, "It's up to you." As a result, I think we practiced harder. We had to invent our own practice period ourselves. And of course, it fit much better into our life. A few years ago, Jane interviewed me, and printed out the interview, which gives a sort of overview of our way of doing practice period. So Donna Lynn just copied that for us, and I want everybody to have a copy. Maybe pass it around both sides. And then I also put together a more thorough explanation, because this time we'll do something that we've only done once before. Thank you, Jane. And that is that we're going to have a shuso. A shuso is the head practicer, it's called. It's a very paradoxical position, because it sounds like it's elevating somebody when in fact it's making it harder. The shuso dedicates herself or himself to supporting the Sangha all during the six-week practice period in every possible way. It's designed, of course, for young monks in a monastery, and so some of the things are kind of ludicrous for us, like the shuso has to scrub the toilets during Sesshin. When I was at Felsentor in January, the shuso was a big German man, and he'd never scrubbed a toilet in his entire life. And so it was a really big deal for him. And so you can feel what that's about. It's bringing somebody down to size, you could say. So we still incorporate that, but mostly what shuso does is to support the Sangha and offer herself or himself for meetings, offers space for people to sew or to drink tea together or have classes like our Sando Kai classes. It's considered to be a kind of priest in training position after a priest has had some length of time to begin to find the way. The way of being a priest is very exposed. Kobin always said wearing the okesa is like wearing the inside on the outside. And so it's a very vulnerable position in many ways. but it's also an opportunity to practice more deeply. The more vulnerable we allow ourselves to become, the more our bravery takes us to deeper places. So it's a great honor for the Sangha when someone first agrees to ordain as a priest and then to take on the job of being a head practicer, especially since at the end of the 6 weeks, in order to prove the shuso-ness of it, the shuso sits in this position and receives very sharp, penetrating questions one by one from every single person who is there. And the hope is that many people come and many people challenge shuso, challenge her practice. How is it with you? What is the meaning of life? It's the kind of thing that you can no longer do from here. And that's the whole issue in the first place. That the more we can live and speak from here, the more true we are, the more honest, and the more in tune with Buddha nature, you could say. And the more able we are to live a bodhisattva life, live a life of precepts. So in most Zen centers, there's a ceremony at this point, a sort of entering, shuso entering ceremony. So we're now going to have a shuso entering ceremony. If Donna Lynn would stand up and bring her sitting equipment over here, then from now, for the first 6 weeks, you'll sit here. And if you're Doan, you can just bring the bell. Thank you very much for accepting this position. And please help us help you so that we know what you need as you're serving our needs. And don't take it too seriously.
Yes. Thank you. Can you get anything like right now? Can you get anything like right now?
Yeah. This is it. So I read you what I wrote, and then you can take this home as a kind of reference. This is a tradition, it's called Ango, or peaceful life. So keep that in mind as you live this 6 weeks. This is a tradition that began in Buddha's time when the monks retired to practice together in a group during the rainy season. In a monastic setting, monks' practice becomes even more focused on zazen with much study and with interaction with the shuso, the head practicer. In our lay life at Floating Zendo, we've taken this tradition into our homes, our meeting place, and sesshin once or twice a year, vowing to deepen our practice in ways that fit into the rhythm of our life. Below are suggestions on how you can participate in this precious deepening of your practice within the shelter and support of your teacher and fellow Sangha members. Shuso, head practicer, is a priest in training who leads a practice period, manifesting the bodhisattva teachings for the sake of everyone, from the first evening to the final day of sesshin 6 weeks later, when members of the Sangha can one by one question her or him in a public ceremony. The head practicer is supported by the Sangha in this further stepping down practice, and all are encouraged to participate as much as possible. The head practicer is expected to serve any request from the Sangha, ring the wake-up bell at sesshin, clean toilets at sesshin, offer time and space to meet with Sangha members with tea, sympathy, and good humor. The Sangha is expected to keep commitments and meet with and support Shuso in every way. For those who live far away, it's suggested that contact with Shuso can be made and kept by email and telephone, and that for the ceremony, questions be sent ahead of time so that the Eno can read them out. Suggestions for deepening practice in Ango: commit to sitting more than usual at home, memorize a chant or a sutra, study a sutra or some teachings, join every Tuesday evening, join Shuso's sittings. Donalyn is going to sit on Monday evenings at her place. Choose a precept as your special study and just keep it by you the whole 6 weeks, one that's special for you. Participate in Sesshin. Have tea with Shuso. Have Dogsan at least once with the teacher. And possibly do an individual retreat of a day or so. There may be other things that you think of. And it could be all of the above if you're really ambitious for your practice. The whole point is to do what is true for you. Thank you. Some of us were at the wonderful women's retreat up in North Fork and came back yesterday. It was really, really nice. It was a combination of zazen. There were four sits a day starting at 7 o'clock in the morning. We got to sleep in. There were classes in the history of women in Buddhism. There were very subtle, quiet body work classes that were more like taking a nap on the Zendo floor. And then there were writing classes, which I generated. And the thing that came out of the writing class that was so interesting for me was that the bottom line that people discovered and announced, we shared a lot, read our work, everybody read her work, and then shared insights. And the most basic insight was about the truth, that you can write a lot of different ways. You can represent yourself in a lot of different ways, your experience, your story, your fantasies, your wishes and desires. But if you're really trying to express yourself in a creative way, what you're aiming for and finding resistance to, so that you end up with a very interesting kind of tension, is what's true. Is it really true? Of course, we did a lot of swimming also. There's a beautiful pool there. So on top of those four subjects, we also did some recreational swimming and talking. There was lots of talking. And people were from all over. They came from Santa Cruz and Sacramento and Berkeley and Colorado and So there was a lot of interesting interaction between people who were very serious about their sitting practice, as well as all those other things. But that bottom line truth is, of course, what this precept is that we had this week about no lying. What is it to be true? What is it to tell the truth? How do we know? So I've been very interested to hear you all talk about that a little bit too, what your experience was on this subject, what it is on this subject.
There is an exercise that Angie asked us to do in a writing, in our writing session at the weekend retreat, and I had a lot of resistance to doing it. It was where she do some free writing for 10 minutes and then go back and pull from it or look at it and take the essence of it or something like that and rewrite it. Of course, since I've learned that when I have that much resistance to something, that I just better just do it, just see what it's all about. And I was just doing the free writing, and what Angie said about it was, you know, and a lot of the free associating writing was just kind of like how my head talked.
And blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, kind of running along, this and that. And then at the very end, when we were asked to look at it again, it was something that, well, it was a and I'll go ahead and share it, was a haiku, and it just came out of nowhere, yet I know how it was the truth. It wasn't made up at all. It was very interesting, very interesting. How writing is a transformative art, and it's a way to get to the truth.
The same
very,
place.
Very interesting. And listening to people, it was pretty amazing. It was a pretty amazing experience.
It was a beautiful haiku. Can you remember it?
What do I need or want to realize my Dharma name? Waxing summer moon. I was not thinking about any of that until it came out. What do I need or want to realize Seiko waxing someone?
Thank you. What we discovered as we wrote was, of course, the writing comes from the same place as Zazen, so that it's out of our control. We get to allow ourselves to be surprised as we write. And it's just like Zazen in that people come and say, I can't possibly do this. I'm not a writer. Just like people say, oh, I don't know how you sit Zazen. I could never do that. And yet everybody has it in them. And if they have the opportunity, then they're just so surprised. Oh my gosh, how did I do this? And everybody, people came up to me afterwards. And there were some people who didn't say anything during the class, and I thought, well, I guess I bombed with them. It just didn't work. Somehow the process didn't work. And then they came back at the very last day with tears saying, oh, thank you so much. It just opened up everything for me. So those of you who write know what this is. It's like magic in a way. But so is Zazen. It's the same place. And so is the truth. So it's about awakening in Buddha's mind, as Koban said. It's finding the true mind of us, our Buddha nature, not the fancy self that we keep throwing up and hoping will fool everybody in some kind of way. Samuel?
Kind of a different subject, but along the same line. Why do you tell a sense of shame not to read or write? I can kind of understand the reading, but the writing, there's so much that's happening, and so I can't even remember what I had for breakfast. Sometimes, you know,
yeah,
aha moments happen, and, you know.
Well, it's about learning to let all of that go, just for a little while. It's a practice of letting go and non-attachment. And if it's a really good idea, it will return. Mostly it's just balderdash. But if it's a good one, it'll come back. So it's, the main thing is just to make this one activity, just this one activity of plain being without anything else to go with it at all. It's frustrating, I know. I'm always wanting to write during session.
Not really. Now it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Jane?
My brother asked me to do something, and I didn't do it. And so I'm writing him an email to just give him all these reasons, and it took me like hours to write this email. And my husband's like, he didn't say that, but he's like, we've got work to do, what are you doing? And so he finally advised me to leave it and think about it and come back to it. So I did, and the next day I just told him the truth, and I don't want to do it, I'm not going to do it. And the difference between being able to just write that and saying what was true, and there's nothing malicious about it, it's just something I don't want to do, and this long garbled... So he was up in the country and didn't get my email, and he phoned me that day. And he asked me if I would do that thing, and I said, well, you know, I'm not going to do it. Not like that, but I told him I was going to do it. And no problem. And it's discerning that place of now that I've told him, it's kind of opened up this naturalness and sense of freedom that it does make it more real. It would have rushed at something, and I don't want to rush it. So now I get to have that.
Yeah.
So it just is a much more real thing now than before. Mm-hmm. When I'm trying to think of what someone in my situation would say, or you know, you kind of like have all these ways of you're writing towards something, or you're trying to figure out what would be the right thing to say. Mm-hmm. It's all just a big spin.
It's a great example. Thank you. No,
okay.
You were first.
So I guess lying is something that really I like to think about. Like, I remember when I was young, I sort of had this issue of compulsive truth-telling. And so this has a lot of resonance for me. But about a month ago, I started having a lot of gloomy thoughts. I read a National Geographic article about how our world food supply, at least the grain food supply, has, or rather the demand, has surpassed our supply. And from there, I just sort of... You know, we're headed towards peak oil, and all these species are dying. I miss the no-killing night. But, and so but thinking about the no lie, and maybe even how we do it anyway, and how do we recognize what is the truth, I realize that my brain, or the voice inside of my head, or the direction that my thoughts go, lies to me too. I have a real predilection for doom and gloom. And but like my life has an unreliable narrator, sort of. And so it's not exactly no lying or me trying not to lie, but realizing how deep a work it is recognizing what is true.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
That even my own thoughts have their mm-hmm. own. I guess the word is bias, but
they do. It's all conditioning. It's conditioning balderdash.
Yeah. And that was very freeing because I was able to finally see that even though I am pretty convinced of all these horrible things, I don't have to keep going with the thought. I can let it go.
Yeah. It doesn't stick unless you cultivate it. You can bow to it. Thank you very much. And you're right. You're right. But goodbye. But it primes you for a true thought like that, even if it's very dour. It still primes you for being able, if something comes along in your life, to do something about it. You're bound to do it. So it's not for nothing. It's just that you find the balance and the equanimity in that knowledge, in the truth of what you've discovered in your mind, without being knocked off base by it.
And I was watching a documentary, and some of the people said that in the late 60s, many people felt the same way, that the world is never going to be the same again.
Yes.
And then 10 years later, it was.
Yes. Yes. When I was a girl, there were scientists who were saying that the world is going to freeze. The ocean is going to freeze. Thank you. That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Me too.
So, similarly to Britt, I'm all mixed up about what is the truth. And it's like I thought I knew, and as time goes on and on, I know less and less and less of what that means. And I think about morality, it's thought of like lying is bad, you know, telling the truth is good. It's very clear, and when I grew up, and that's just how I lived, and I needed to be good, and I didn't lie. And then, and I kept with that, and I went to law school and everything. And then now that I'm working, it's like I understand why people think lawyers are kind of always tell the truth. Because it's like our job, which is admirable, it really is, to present one side of the story in the best light possible.
Yes, yes.
And then there'll hopefully be someone doing it on the other side, and then hopefully an impartial person who can take all that in. And it's so interesting with my clients, because it's like I'm like confused myself, because I'm like trying to coach them, and I'm like, yeah, but don't lie, but tell the truth, you're going to have to swear. They're like, you're telling me to tell the truth, but I don't know what to say. Tell me, well, you just tell the truth. And then they're like, okay, but what is that? I just told you something, and you didn't like that. I'm like, yeah, don't say that. And so it's like I'm all like mixed up, and especially with immigration stuff, like fraud is a big thing. And like immigration thinks like anything, any lie is fraud. So it's like,
oh
like,
boy,
I'm especially careful. But at the same time, I don't know what's a lie and what's not a lie.
So yeah, yeah.
Confusing myself now, but and also working with people from different cultures, what they believe is
yes.
a lie, what
yes.
in our culture is that was one big hurdle. Get over it. So, and so you don't understand. In our country, everybody does that.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yeah. But you can't do that. And you're like, why? I'm like, because it's a lie. I'm like, but why? That's what we do. And so, I don't know anymore. So it's the first thing when you were saying about writing and finding truth. I'm like, I don't know what does that mean. And I mean, is there such a thing as truth? Like,
in each moment. That's what you find when you're writing. There's no overall picture. It's just right here, right now, in each situation. And that's the frustrating part, because then there's no rule about it. We can't just say, oh, and now I know what to do. We have to find out each time.
And then how do we prepare for the future?
Well, we have to touch down over and over. We have to sit a lot, basically, as well as study what we're doing. But it's the sitting that through which we reach Buddha nature, Buddha mind. And as you know, Buddha mind doesn't always follow the exact rules of a culture. It follows the exact rules of a situation, the life of a basic being in a moment. So you have to trust it real much, and that's the hard part, is to trust. And help the people that you're with trust themselves, their deep nature, rather than the superficial part. You have a wonderful job.
Yeah.
Still enjoyable. Yeah. Lucky woman. Yeah. Thank you. Well, it's 8, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the next one so that you can think about it during the week. And that is no selling the wine of delusion, which is such a funny way of saying it. But it's about, as Colvin said, alcohol is hardly the problem compared to everything else. How we fool ourselves. So in a way, that's what we're talking about here too. How we try to present ourselves as something different. How we try to imagine for ourselves something that we are not. That we feed ourselves delusion. We create delusion in order to meet with other people, so that we live in a kind of dream very often. And alcohol, the spirits that the AA people say, you know, the people are looking for spirit and they find it in alcohol. But that just covers up spirit. It replaces it with a damaged body and a damaged mind. So finding the true self, and it's somewhat what Britt is saying, of where in all this that we're throwing up in ourself all the time, all the ideas and images and hopes and dreams, where's the truth in that? And where's the real self of us? Where's our meaning? Our meaning, not what we've been taught, not what the culture is trying to enforce in us. So it's our study, moment by moment, it's our study. Self-consciousness and self-centeredness is a big part of this precept. Being the star, or the king of the situation, or the queen. You know, ta-da, here I am. That's a kind of intoxication. It's overwhelming the self with something. So the trick, or the truth of it, is how very, it's again what Britt was saying, it's how plain things are, how simple things are, really. And that our tendency is to get nervous about things, how things are going, and feel that we should do something, when actually, as you were saying, Ritu, it's just a matter of trusting the situation itself, rather than fiddling with it all the time. Because fiddling is kind of clouding it up and creating stories on top of the story. The real story is very, very basic, very, very simple. peaceful. So, Coben said, if your practice causes deep appreciation and respect, there is peace and satisfaction in there. That kind of thing is what real religion causes in you. And he had some very sharp things to say about the kind of religion that creates clouds and clouds of expectation and ideas and hopes and dreams when all along life is going along in its simple, plain way. So I'll leave you with that, and we'll talk about it next week. Are there questions about any of... I've said a lot tonight, I know.
How does sitting get you to the Buddha nature? What is it about the sitting that gets you there?
Yes, well, it's a really good question. That's the most profound question of all. Where is Buddha? How do you find it? So, you could say, sitting is it? Sitting itself is Buddha. And the more you sit, the more the baloney drops off. You can see what's true and what's just fantasy. You begin to see the hard truth. There are many hard truths in sitting. It's not a beautiful proposition at all. But as you begin to really look, experience the hard truths in your sitting, the nonsense begins to dissipate. You just see through it. There's an awful lot of just foolishness in our mind that we take seriously. So with real sitting, we begin to see what's serious and what isn't.
So all those thoughts that come and go.
Yes. Most of them are. Yeah. You kiss them as they fly, as Blake said. Bye-bye. But there's something in there. There's something there. There's something here as you sit. There's something in your breathing, what breathes you and lives you beyond the thoughts. Thank you, Francois. That's a good question.